Hey, it's Nishant, and welcome to Higher IQ. Hey everyone, it is Monday, July 20th. Spain won the World Cup yesterday, beating Argentina 1-0 at MetLife Stadium. Messi is 39 years old, and that was almost certainly his last World Cup match, although that has not been officially claimed or disclosed yet. I think Americans always talk about soccer in the World Cup, like during the World Cup every 4 years, but it feels like recently I just kept hearing the same thing that, oh, if LeBron played soccer or Tyreek Hill played soccer or any of our best athletes, if they focused on the sport, then the U.S. would dominate and we wouldn't have lost to Belgium and all these things. I actually believe that a lot of Americans think that this is true, and I used to think that it made sense because American athletes are bigger, faster, and stronger than most of the world. But then I started looking into how elite soccer players are actually made, and the argument falls apart almost immediately. Messi is 5'7". He was actually diagnosed with a growth hormone deficiency at the age of 11 that made him smaller than every other kid on the field. He left his family in Argentina at the age of 13 to move to Barcelona's youth academy. The greatest soccer player in history is the least physically imposing athlete in any room that he walks into, and he didn't become the best because of his body, but rather because he entered a development system at the age of 6 years old and then spent the next decade building skills that American youth sports don't even prioritize. The U.S. doesn't lose at soccer because of a talent shortage. It loses because the entire system is built to produce something else. In most of the world, elite soccer development works like this. Professional clubs identify talented kids as young as 5 or 6 years old. Then they bring them into free academies funded by the club and train them daily alongside professional coaches. Barcelona's La Masia Academy, where Messi trained, has produced some of the greatest players in history and doesn't charge families a cent for it. The club invests in the kid because the kid is the asset, and if the kid develops into a professional, then the club earns millions when they play for the first team or get transferred to another club. FIFA's solidarity payment system sends a percentage of every professional transfer fee back to the clubs that developed the player from ages 12 onward. So the return on developing a talented 6-year-old can take a decade to materialize, but it can be enormous when it actually does. In the United States, youth soccer works in the opposite direction. Parents pay club fees, tournament entry, travel costs, private coaching, showcases, and they have to buy the equipment that can add up to somewhere between $3,000 and $15,000 per year, depending on the level. A 2016 study found that only 2% of competitive youth soccer players in the U.S. came from families earning under $50,000 a year. The talent pool isn't filtered by ability. It's filtered by income, and that changes everything about who gets developed. If Messi had grown up in Houston instead of Rosario, his family, which was working class, almost certainly couldn't have afforded the path into elite youth soccer in America. The same goes for Neymar, who grew up in poverty in Brazil, or Luka Modric, who grew up as a refugee during the Croatian War of Independence, or even Cristiano Ronaldo, whose father was a municipal gardener who struggled with alcoholism. The greatest players in the history of the sport came from backgrounds that would have been priced out of American youth soccer. But let's be honest here. Soccer doesn't have to be expensive. All you really need is a ball and any flat surface, right? The same as basketball. Kids in Brazil play barefoot in the street. But in America, soccer just isn't prioritized the way that basketball or football is. And if you're a kid who's elite at multiple sports, well, then the system gives you every reason to play something else. And by the way, there's a structural reason why American clubs charge parents instead of investing in kids. U.S. soccer has historically refused to enforce FIFA's training compensation rules domestically. When a youth club in Seattle developed DeAndre Yedlin, who later transferred to Tottenham Hotspur for millions, the club filed for its roughly $60,000 share of the solidarity payment. Well, guess what? It got nothing. If developing a player earns you $0 when they turn pro, well, then the only way to fund your academy is to charge the families. The parent becomes the customer, not the player. And the product becomes whatever keeps the parent writing the checks. Travel tournaments, showcase weekends, and expensive private training sessions rather than the kind of daily, long-term technical development that produces world-class players. Even if you fix the pay-to-play problem, there's a second structural issue that's just as important. The best American athletes don't choose soccer because the economic incentives point elsewhere. The minimum salary in the NFL is $885,000 a year. The average MLS salary is around $660,000 a year. If you're a 16-year-old American who is elite at multiple sports, which happens more often than people realize, the rational financial decision is to pursue football, basketball, or even baseball, all of which offer college scholarships worth tens of thousands of dollars and professional leagues that pay significantly more than soccer. The pipeline from high school to college scholarship to professional contract in those sports is well-established and well-funded. The equivalent pipeline in American soccer barely exists. In Europe and South America, soccer is the pipeline. There's no college sports system competing for the same athletes. A talented 16-year-old in Spain or Argentina isn't choosing between soccer and something else. Soccer is the path to wealth, to fame, and social mobility, just like basketball is for a kid growing up in inner-city Chicago. The cultural depth of soccer in those countries isn't just about passion, it's about infrastructure. Every neighborhood has a club. Every club feeds into a professional system. And the professional system pays well enough to make the sport the obvious choice for any kid with talent. Pedri, who plays for Barcelona and Spain, was competing in La Liga at 16 years old. Jude Bellingham from England was starting for Borussia Dortmund in the Bundesliga League at 17 years old. At that same age, the most talented American soccer players are entering the college system, where the season is only a few months long, the training is less rigorous than a professional academy, and the development environment is designed around academics rather than producing professional athletes. By the time an American player turns pro at 22, their European counterpart has 5 or 6 years of professional experience. So when someone says, if LeBron played soccer, America would win the World Cup, they're not wrong about LeBron per se. I think they're just wrong about what makes a great soccer player. Soccer is not a sport where being the biggest, fastest, or even the most explosive athlete wins. It's a sport where spatial awareness, first touch, vision, creativity, and thousands of hours of technical repetition from childhood produce the difference between good and great. A Slate article published during this tournament described American players as ripped, fast robots that rarely developed elite touch and get their thirst for improvisation trained out of them. American kids are coached to be athletic, while European and South American kids are coached to be skilled. And the difference shows up every time the U.S. played a top-tier opponent and our players looked physically capable but technically outmatched. Leo Messi is the perfect living proof of this. He is smaller and slower than most professional athletes in any sport. What he has is a spatial intelligence and ball control developed over 33 years of daily practice that started when he was just 6 years old in a system that was free, run by professional coaches, and designed to develop exactly the skills that American youth soccer charges families a fortune to not teach. The gap between the U.S. and the world's best soccer nations isn't athleticism, but a development system that treats the sport as a technical discipline requiring childhood immersion, funded by the professional clubs who benefit from the output, rather than a recreational activity funded by parents who are told that their kid might get a college scholarship if they play enough showcase tournaments. So in yesterday's World Cup finals, Spain and Argentina, you just remember that neither team got there because their athletes were bigger or faster than everyone else. They got there because their systems identified talented kids early. They then trained them for free, developed their technical skills daily from childhood, and then put them in professional environments by the age of 16 rather than into college classrooms by 18. The thing that's sitting with me with this episode is how simple the math is. The greatest soccer player in history is 5'7" with a growth hormone deficiency, and he's been training since he was 6 at an academy that was completely free. In America, that path costs up to $15,000 a year, which means we're not really filtering kids by their talent, we're filtering them by their parents' income, and the ones who could be great never get the chance because the system wasn't built for them. So if you ask me, I just don't think that the U.S. is ever going to be a soccer powerhouse. It is not about the athletes. It's, first of all, we need to build a better system to allow our best athletes to play soccer. But then on top of that, we need to give them the incentives. And with basketball and football and even baseball being just such an integral part of American culture and society, I just don't see us making that trade-off. I think those three sports I named are always going to be the highest paying. And for an elite athlete, they're going to probably just choose one of those. So just remember that there's no reason that America couldn't do the same thing as these other South American and European countries. It's just that we haven't wanted to yet. And like I said, probably never will. Stay informed, stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.